是中国。
That's why China, the China podcast from Thuringia in Germany.
Welcome and thanks for tuning in to a further episode in our podcast from Thuringia in Germany on building up regional China competence.
Today we have with us Anisha Baczolska.
She's policy fellow in the Asia program at the European Council on Foreign Relations and is located in Warszawa. She's doing research on the relations between East European countries and China and has worked at the Polish Asia Research Center, the think tank affiliated with Poland's Ministry of National Defense. She also holds a PhD from the Graduate School for Social Research at the Polish Academy of Science, has a master's degree from Shanghai Fudan University in International Politics, and has also studied at the renowned School of Oriental and African Studies in London. So she has a broad knowledge on security issues with cooperation with China and can give insight on easier view on China. So, Alicia, hello and welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I would like to start with a big picture before going into detail. And the European Commission has chosen the formula that China is partner, competitor, and rival. Where do you see China as a partner and where do you see rivalry?
That's a great question. I think that, first of all, I would say that this division of labor, let's say, created by the Commission has been already quite dated. So this was created back in 2019, before the pandemic, before Russia's full-scale aggression against Ukraine, and before China has actually introduced a lot of policies that are now pushing this broader picture much more, for Europeans at least, much more towards the territory of rivalry. In the past, I think that kind of the common sense approach towards China in many European capitals was that partnership is the way to go. China was seen as, you know, this global powerhouse of economic development. And although geographically different capitals would look at China through different lens, the overall assessment was that all European countries were striving towards cooperation with Beijing. But now the picture has changed dramatically, especially, I would say, since 2022, since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. And the way China has approached this war has dramatically changed the way many Europeans, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, look at China. If you look at partnerships, there are still willingness, let's say, in some capitals to go back to business as usual. But these are very, very small compared to how the landscape looked like, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago. We are approaching the EU-China summit that is supposed to take place later in July in Beijing. It seems that partnership is not really very much on the Europeans' agenda. The rumors we are hearing and the kind of messaging that is coming out from the European Commission suggests that Europeans are really fed up with kind of China's current behavior towards Europe. So on the one hand, in the economic realm, Beijing has been very consciously and very steadily implementing policies based on the idea of economic security being at the core of China's strategic interests. In this regard, China has, given its scale and given its political system, China has tools to actually influence the situation of third markets like the European market by default because of the way its economic system works. And here I'm mostly talking about the issue of overcapacity. This is like a slogan or a catchphrase that we've been hearing a lot in the European-China debate over the past year or two. And it basically means that for China, the assessment currently is that its most important frame of reference is Beijing's strategic rivalry with the US. It is increasingly seen in China in existential terms. So there is a strong conviction that is emanating from the discourse produced by the Chinese Communist Party that the US is trying to contain China. And it is an existential threat. So all political power, all political ambition is now geared towards mitigating this bigger risk. And all other relationships of China with third countries or regions are somehow seen as a function of this bigger rivalry with the US. And here for Europeans, it means that they are actually feeling or experiencing the side effects of China's industrial policy, for example, or security policy. And it is becoming very much based on this idea of rivalry instead of partnership.
If I get it right, it's like from both sides, it's been like a rivalry, or do you say China is reacting on the European view on China?
So China is looking at the US through the prism of rivalry, but Europe, I think, is seen as China as a secondary player. If you look at the political messaging coming from Beijing, there is definitely a strong push to go back to quote-unquote business as usual. So trying to kind of use the old narrative that, look, let's cooperate, let's try to find a common ground. Europeans are talking about overcapacity, but there is no such a thing in China. This is, again, quote-unquote, a natural outcome of China's developmental path. We're producing more things because we are more competitive than you are. And again, this is a very limited kind of snapshot of the debate, ignoring the fact that, you know, there are massive subsidies in the Chinese system and that the whole economy is backed up by state support. But this is the level of official rhetoric. So China is trying to position itself still as a partner for Europe. So the rivalry dimension between the EU and China is very much ignored in the official narrative coming from Beijing. But for Europeans, this rivalry aspect is very much felt inside of our economies. Look at what happened to the German automotive sector, how Chinese competition from Chinese electric vehicles is affecting the industrial landscape of Europe as a whole. So we have a lot of these elements in which China is really becoming so much more competitive, but it's not purely because of how great Chinese companies are doing, and many of them are doing quite great, but because of the mass scale of Chinese state support for these companies and the way how Chinese system works, we have to, as Europeans, look at the rivalry angle much more, because in the long run, if we ignore it, we are going to end up in a situation when we are dominated by Chinese industry, which by default would also mean deindustrialization of Europe. And this is a big problem. And we are at the very beginning of this process at the moment. If you look at the broader public debate on China, we are still not feeling very badly the consequences of this situation, but we are already seeing it if you look at Chinese policymaking and the whole kind of situation where there are third markets, for example, in Southeast Asia, where these countries are acting really decisively to prevent Chinese overcapacity from entering their market because they are feeling it much closer than we do at the moment. But we are, I think this is the decisive point at the moment where Europeans have to decide whether we are willing to kind of acknowledge that China's behavior is actually not about partnership anymore, because these pockets of partnership are very limited because of the broader geopolitical dynamic where China is positioning itself in the survival mode. And also, it's not kind of the same partner as 10 or 15 years ago, because the situation, the international situation, has changed so dramatically. And we have to acknowledge the fact that we could potentially, under Donald Trump's presidency, face double challenges of, you know, having a trade war with the US and potentially a trade war with China.
This does not really sound promising.
No, it doesn't.
I would like to come back. You said overcapacity. The government in Beijing doesn't say we have overcapacity. How is it seen by the business actors in China?
In Chinese economy, if you look at it in long-term perspective, there are these cycles. If the government decides that there are strategic sectors in which it has to invest in, it will create those incentives for firms to kind of compete for state support. And this, over a few years, results in this upsurge of many, many companies that are competing between each other, also leading to drops in prices, which for a consumer, theoretically, it is good. But it also means that there is a huge loss of capital and energy put into this process. And now we are also witnessing this in China. So if you look at the messaging coming out from some Chinese EV companies, it's very clear that many, many of them are going bankrupt. Most of them are actually not making profit because of the scale of competition and how, like, this downward spiral is affecting the business environment. On the one hand, this is good for China's strategic goal of kind of overtaking the global EV market because now they have these champions. But domestically, there's a huge problem of companies going bankrupt because of how unsustainable the system is. These developments are very well seen by China watchers in Europe, But I think it hasn't yet trickled down to kind of the broader public debate about China among Europeans outside of this China bubble. And I see this as a problem because we are still not seeing a massive influx, for example, of Chinese EVs on our streets. They are out there, but it's not like from one day to another, you see that they are dominating the streets. And this is only part of the problem. So it's not only about the fact that, you know, these cars are probably cheaper. They are cheaper, of course. They are in many cases much more attractive to consumers in Europe because they're just cutting edge. They are very beautiful, they're very attractive, they're very modern, and they're cheaper. So this theoretically sounds like a win-win. And European consumers would like to buy them. But if you look at the broader kind of perspective, systemically, because of how subsidized they are, how they are also part of China's strategy to create and build this kind of links with third markets that would ensure economic security. So kind of tying and making these markets, third markets, dependent on Chinese products. This means that these cars are not only potentially contributing to Europe's deindustrialization, because many companies, European companies, are not going to be able to compete with these Chinese automakers, but also in the security dimension, these cars are like supercomputers. You know, they have cameras everywhere. They are extremely capable of gathering data on the streets of Europe. And because China is so much focused on its rivalry with the US, it is also very much focused on security. In China at the moment, everything is about security. You have this concept of comprehensive national security, where all areas of life are kind of subject to this security thinking. So we have to remember that also these cars are not only consumer goods, but they are also potentially in the context of the Internet of Things and how, you know, we are moving towards having these autonomous vehicles in the future. They are an element in this network that can be used for security reasons if there's political will on China's side. And that's another argument that we tend to forget in Europe when talking about them.
Well, this sounds like weaponized trade, or we buy you nice consumer stuff, but there's a backdoor. Is there by default a China threat? And do we have to take security measures as well?
Well, I believe that it all boils down to the way Europeans think about China. So many in Europe still have quite outdated perception of China's economic power and economic coercion. So of course, as I said before, for many, many years, we were looking at China only through the lens of partnership. So back then, this economic dimension was purely about short-term economic gains of many companies. And many European companies have made millions and billions out of this kind of business. And if, you know, in retrospect, 20 years ago, this was a very advantageous situation. Again, in retrospect, it looks naive, but now it's clear that we are moving towards a very, very different direction. And here, if European decision makers still keep on thinking about China using these outdated concepts and definitions of what China is, what China wants, what China is after, this will lead to bad policy making. Because if we don't acknowledge what China wants at the moment, and this is not like, you know, top secret knowledge, if you look at party state documents, if you look at strategies, if you look at different kinds of publications by Chinese think tanks, it is all out there. It's very clear what China wants. But in Europe, many people still prefer to kind of brush it off and think, well, China is far away. We have bigger problems on our plate. There is Russia. There's the war in Ukraine, which, again, is kind of connected to China as well. But we prefer not to think about it in this way.
All right. You just mentioned Ukrainian situation. Well, you're in Poland, you have a border with Ukraine. How do people view China in situation in Ukraine? And how close is China with Russia?
That's a great question. I think there's a growing consensus that China-Russia relationship is much more than a mere marriage of convenience. For many years, I think this was kind of the dominant view, and that Europeans and Americans might have these tools or strategies to tear Russia and China apart and push them away. But if you look at what has happened since 2022 and the beginning of the Russian full-scale aggression against Ukraine and how China positioned itself vis-a-vis this war, it becomes very, very clear that China-Russia relationship is much more than just a marriage of convenience. And they don't need to have a formal alliance. I think that Europeans, often in the European debates, we have a tendency to say, oh, they don't have an alliance, so, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's just something very fluid. Yes, it is fluid, but you don't have to have an alliance in order to work hand in hand and coordinate some of your policies to work towards building an alternative world order or rebuild the existing one to the benefit of China and Russia. If you look at documents, for example, the infamous joint declaration by Putin and Xi that was issued 2 weeks before the beginning of the war in Ukraine, when Putin visited Beijing for the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics in February 2022, it is very clear that they are not hiding the fact that their joint interest is to weaken the U.S.-led international order, work towards quote-unquote democratization of international order, and that China has consistently been saying that it is in Beijing's interest to undermine or to rebuild the existing security architecture in Europe to accommodate, quote-unquote, legitimate security concerns of Russia, which you cannot be more clearer about what your strategic goal is. And then if you combine this with a lot of evidence that is actually published openly by Chinese customs office about the scale of economic support, sales of dual-use technologies, microchips to Russia over the past couple of years, this leads you to a conclusion that if it was not for China, the war in Ukraine would look very, very, very different. It is China's economy that is fueling also Russia's war machine. And we know that, but this realization has trickled down to Central and Eastern Europe, but with a varying degree of concern, I would say. So you have countries like the Baltics who are extremely, especially Lithuania, very, very clear about the fact that how detrimental China-Russia relationship is to European security. Then you have, for example, Poland that is a little bit kind of sitting on the fence. So if you look at we had two different governments throughout the war in Ukraine. Both of these governments have been consistent in saying that we see what China is doing with Russia. This is unacceptable to us. We see that China is contributing to war efforts in Ukraine. But at the same time, because of the fact that I mentioned, the fact that we have so many other immediate problems, a more assertive China policy did not really follow because there is still this belief that we should not rock the boat too hard and that we just have to focus on our immediate threat on the border. But definitely the perception of China in Central and Eastern Europe has shifted tremendously. The only exception within the EU in the region is, of course, Hungary, the Trojan horse of European unity on many, many fronts. And I'm not going to go into details here because what Hungary is doing is the result of domestic dynamic inside of the country. But Hungary has made a strategic bet, and on China front, it's the same logic.
Well, you said China tries to change the European security matter. Down in my heart, I always thought, well, China is not interested to change anything in Europe. It's just to keep their system working. Do we really have to be afraid?
Well, frankly, from the Polish perspective, look at this kind of a scenario. For China, when it comes to the war in Ukraine, the worst case scenario is actually Ukraine's win. Because this would mean that the U.S., no matter whether it's Trump or some other politician in the future, will have much more influence on Ukraine as well, NATO, the EU. So it would mean westernization of Ukraine, ongoing kind of process in which liberal democracies, or however you call this kind of congregation of countries that are not always liberal and not always fully democratic, but anyway, this kind of bloc thinking is very alive in Chinese thinking as well. Although officially China keeps on saying that we are against Cold War mentality, this is the way they look at dynamics in the world, I'm afraid, that it's still like kind of a projection of anti-Cold War mentality while kind of looking at the world in this way, that there are spheres of influence and that certain big countries can go over the heads of smaller countries because of this kind of social Darwinist belief and historical experiences in the 19th century, the century of humiliation, how China has been subjugated to bigger powers. There is this element where China is very much afraid, but also trying to act like this because of this historical memory. That's at least how I see it. Because of the fact that Ukraine's victory is detrimental to China's security, We have to remember, and I guess that, you know, a lot of communication coming from China and conversations with Chinese intellectuals and thinkers point towards this direction. It is a strategic choice. If China thinks about its position in the world currently, there is this whole debate about great changes unseen in a century. So it's a diagnosis of the world affairs, of the state of the world we're living in, which I think that China is quite correctly assuming. So that we are going through this historic period where the balance of power is reformulating. And for China, it's a period of a lot of threats, but also opportunities. So China has to navigate through this environment in order to maximize its own wins, but also to diminish the threats. But here, the relationship with Russia is a function of this kind of thinking. So yes, China and Russia historically have had a complicated relationship. But as long as there is this threat coming from the US, which is seen existentially important by Beijing, there are no signs that Beijing will change its mind when it comes to cooperation with Russia. They have to cooperate as long as they have a shared enemy. And, you know, there is a lot of debate when it comes to this reverse Kissinger move under Trump. So the attempts of the Americans to actually get closer with Russians, to isolate China and to kind of change the broader process in which China-Russia relationship is so important. The situation now is so different compared to what, you know, the Kissinger period was. And if you talk to Chinese academics and if you read Chinese publications, it's very clear that for them, reverse Kissinger is just a joke. So they don't even have to worry about it because they know why the leadership in Beijing has chosen to cooperate with Russia so closely. And again, this can change in the long run. This is not like it's not set in stone. At this stage, we really have to be very clear that there are no qualitative changes in cooperation between China and Russia that are visible that would suggest that the fundamentals of this relationship are changing.
If we have good connections to China, China can whisper into the ear of Putin to change his behavior. That will help us with our security with Russia.
But the problem is that they don't want to whisper into Putin's ear. But we have no leverage over them. So this could have worked if we had actual economic leverage or any kind of other leverage vis-a-vis China. Now it's just asking them to be nice to Europeans while we see that the fundamental interest of China in this environment is, you know, China is good for China. So China wants to advance its own interests. And the war in Ukraine and Russia's aggression against Ukraine is not in the interest of China. I mean, I'm not saying that China is super happy about the war, but I think that like the way the war has developed, like this kind of protracted long-term conflict in which nobody has to make any decisive moves, it is in China's interest because China, by kind of trying to be like quote-unquote neutral, it has managed to, like, you know, not do anything, actually, keep on having great cooperation with Russia economically while still in the so-called global south, building this image of a responsible power and a global actor that is a force for peace. So the current situation has been serving China very, very well. I do believe that this kind of approach in which we think that Xi can influence Putin is very far-fetched in a way that, yes, in an ideal world, this could happen, but like, what leverage do we have to force China to do that if it's not in China's interest? I've been hearing this argument a lot from Europeans, but I think it's just completely detached from the reality on the ground at the moment. And like, just one thing I will add, because that's, I think it's a fun fact. It's not very fun, but it's a fact. is that, you know, when I discuss China-Russia relationship in Beijing with some people out there from Chinese institutions, it was very clear that reading between the lines, there was this message that we understand that your Central and Eastern European concerns vis-a-vis Russia. We see that it's a threat to you, but you have to understand our perspective. We are now in this existential rivalry mode with the US, and it is in our interest to have a close relationship with Russia. So you do you, Europeans, but we do us. You have no power to change our behavior because we are just trying to take care of our own interests because of the rivalry with the US.
So this sounds like we need to understand more what are the interests of the Chinese people, the Chinese government.
Yeah.
What happens if Russia wins, and what does it mean for Taiwan?
That's a great question, and we've been thinking about it a lot. And it's not an easy one to answer because, of course, Taiwan is not Ukraine. These are two very different regional setups. These are two very different entities. But of course, it's clear that China has been looking and analyzing the process and the war in Ukraine to see what the implications could be for Taiwan. And of course, on the official level, Chinese diplomats or people connected to the party state would say that, you know, you should not compare the two. Like, these are extremely different things. But at the same time, reading between the lines, for example, on when it comes to economic statecraft and working towards securing China from external shocks when it comes to potential sanctions, trade war, or some kind of an escalation, not necessarily a traditional kind of full-scale war, but this kind of coercion process that is happening across the Taiwan Straits for many years now, that it could actually accelerate, and how the way Western countries reacted to the war in Ukraine, what kind of economic restrictions, what kind of tools, what kind of sanctions they used. This is observed very closely from Beijing. And if you look, for example, at the recent meeting between Putin and Xi in May this year, and if you look at the agenda and the outcomes, like what kind of cooperation agreements China and Russia signed during this meeting, it's very clear that they are working hand in hand when it comes to building these alternative structures that could help them overcome international sanctions. So you have, for example, special financial institutions set up in China and Russia to kind of directly deal with economic transactions or financial transactions. China and Russia are working towards de-dollarization. And of course, this is a very kind of early stage of this de-dollarization process, but both countries are looking at it through a security lens. So even if might not be the economic rationale behind it is not very clear, then the security rationale is out there and both countries are working towards that. And there is a lot of publications in China these days about economic security. And the war in Ukraine for sure has been like the catalyst of this kind of thinking, saying that look at how the West responded to the war in Ukraine. China has to be able to be more independent from the international environment, to be more inward looking because of its security concerns. We cannot rule out as China that there will be another round of sanctions or the trade war will accelerate. And that's like, if you think about China reacting to Trump 2.0, it's very clear that they have learned the lesson from Trump 2.1, where some people still thought that, you know, maybe this just it's a hiccup and we're going to go back to usual, normal American style of politics. We had Biden and now we have Trump again. And China has learned the lesson. And coupled with kind of the security developments with the war in Ukraine, it's very clear that China now has a whole set of tools it can use in order to shield itself, but also to coerce foreign countries by, you know, export bans of rare earth minerals, many very strategic materials that are crucial, for example, in the defense industry in Europe and in the US. So China is very aware that it has these cards in hand, as Trump likes to put it. And we're going to see more of it probably, with kind of also the political undertone being that because of the nature of the Chinese political system and kind of the propaganda work that is going at the level of state media outlets, the CCP has been trying very hard to build this identity based on confidence, that Chinese people should be confident that, okay, this is a very difficult situation, but we are able to overcome this. This is something bigger than just an economic kind of a trade war. It's about our dignity. It's about our ability to be this responsible power in the world. It's about reclaiming our place in the world. And I guess in this context, China is in this kind of a trade war, economic security mindset for the long run.
All right. People told me that the pandemic was very costly for China. And right now, the rivalry and the trade war with the USA seems to blow down the Chinese economic powerhouse. And in some way, they say like it's China gets to know it is not self-sufficient, and trade is good for everyone. But it sounds like you're saying, no, China is closing up. We need to be self-sufficient.
There is an official response to kind of the dilemma that you just described, and it's called dual circulation strategy. So this is now the official strategy when it comes to China's overall economic development, meaning that there are these two circulations. One is based on boosting domestic consumption, so trying to absorb some part of this overcapacity by encouraging people to buy and consume more, while at the same time, there is this external circulation, meaning that China is aware that it still is dependent in some areas on cooperation with third countries and third markets. So it's trying to build this kind of connections where it wants to make it much more costly to third countries if they wanted to disengage with China. The EV debate with Europeans is, I would say, a case in point here. But I guess the question about whether this system is going to implode, well, it's a $1 million question. But I think that if you look, for example, at the social sentiment in China at the moment, you have a lot of paradoxes. So on the one hand, there's this whole narrative about self-confidence, about China being ready for a trade war or a potential conflict with some other unnamed bigger power, of course, meaning the US. But on the other hand, if you look, for example, at certain social trends, it's also clear that, for example, young people are not that willing to join this kind of race. So you have these trends like lying flat. So people who are trying to reject the work culture that China has been long associated with. So this kind of a rat race where people have to work overtime constantly to achieve a certain social status. And many young people in China, especially from this generation born in late 1990s and early 2000s, they now see that potentially they're going to be the first generation in the past 30 years that is not going to achieve a higher standard of living compared to their parents. And this is also leading to this kind of involution and withdrawal from society in some cases. Also, the demographic crisis is a big issue. Officially, China is trying to portray the demographic crisis as an opportunity. So an opportunity to use, for example, robotics, robots, AI, in order to mitigate some of the risks associated with the fact that the labor force is going to shrink over time. It's also trying to encourage women to have more children, but it's not working very well. Actually, quite the opposite. A lot of movements that are somehow associated with broadly defined feminism are on the rise in China. And although there is an official crackdown on this kind of organized NGO feminism, if you look at, for example, the popularity of certain films, books, TV series, this kind of feminist message is very much out there. And these products of culture are very popular, which also says something about whether women want to be part of this kind of anti-demographic crisis struggle. And to me, the answer is that many of them are choosing not to have children and to kind of lead a very different lifestyle that the society expects from them in an attempt to kind of, it's like passive resistance strategy politically as well. So they don't want to be part of this kind of rivalry mindset and competition mindset as well.
This sounds for me as China will change from inside. We in Germany always tell economic trade does change a system. China is the getting rich. And why getting rich? People want to have the possibility to have political rights.
Well, the society changes, okay. But the system doesn't change. That's a problem, I think, for us as well, for kind of, you know, having this kind of expectations that, well, of course, societal change is very unexpected. And we saw, for example, at the very end of the pandemic in China, there were like protests on the streets. People were going out and protesting also, like, you know, there were political slogans that were voiced during these protests. But if you look at the scale of this protest, this was a tiny percentile of Chinese society who dared to go out to the streets. And these protests were crushed down immediately. So even if people are kind of becoming unhappy about the reality as it is in China, because of the scale of technological tools China now has, it seems virtually impossible now for me to imagine really large-scale protests leading to any kind of bigger change unfolding now in China. The scale of securitization, cameras on the streets, police forces, AI tracking, data gathering exercises, and how these are kind of intertwined with the security apparatus in China, all these developments mean that there are no actual means for Chinese people to organize themselves in China in order to voice their concerns on a much bigger scale.
Not what I wanted to hear, but it sounds reasonable. Now, we spoke a lot about inside China. Let's get back to Eastern Europe. You say we don't have any leverage with China. China is doing his business. What can we learn from your perspective in Eastern Europe and Poland toward China? What can we do?
Well, I would say, first of all, that the Central and Eastern European experience with China is a very diversified one. The way China approached the region has been to somehow group countries that are historically very, very diverse. So, for example, look at China's infamous 16 plus 1 format for cooperations. This was established almost 15 years ago now to bring together countries from the Baltic region. So countries that are, you know, very much in the north of Europe, and some of them, they identify themselves more as Nordic states rather than Eastern European states. Then we have Visegrad 4, so Poland, Slovakia, Czechia, and Hungary, very much Central Europe. And then you have also Southern Europe. Even Greece at some point became part of this format. So, which is quite, you know, strange to think of Greece as an Eastern European country. But that's how China approached the region. So it tried to like group together many small countries that otherwise, it did not have this multilateral or like semi-multilateral format. It would have to approach every single one separately, wasting a lot of time, wasting a lot of energy. If you look at it in retrospect, it's very clear that China wanted to create the 16 plus 1 initiative just to facilitate bilateral contact within a framework that somehow looked like a multilateral format. But in the end, it was about China organizing these annual summits where all the leaders would meet, and then they would have this kind of one-to-one meetings with Chinese officials, and then they would produce some kind of a document that was all about cooperation and kind of painting this very positive picture of future. Yes, at some point there was a lot of political willingness on both sides to somehow cooperate and to maybe look for areas where there are synergies between their economies, but the experience that followed did not match political expectations. So if you look at the data from the last, well, over 10 years, it's very clear that these political slogans and China's promises, they did not translate into reality. Chinese investment in the region, apart from Hungary and Serbia, remains very, very minimal. In case of Poland, Koreans are investing much more than Chinese in the country. There were these huge expectations towards China becoming this major investor, and they did not materialize. On the contrary, trade deficit only continued to grow. And Poland now has one of the largest trade deficits with China within the EU. It gives China leverage. So, for example, if China wanted to punish Poland politically, it could cut it off from these imports. And many of them are quite important, like, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry, some ingredients that are necessary for the medical industry, they are sourced almost only from China. And this is a big, big problem. So this development, this cooperation was very one-sided. So China was benefiting from it more than Central and Eastern European states, which over time led to kind of disillusionment with what China had promised before. And coupled with the geopolitical tensions being on the rise, Donald Trump, then the pandemic, then the war in Ukraine, it kind of all snowballed into Central and Eastern Europe becoming actually one of the most assertive voices. Many of these countries are now very assertive when it comes to their China policies in the EU. Which is quite paradoxical because, for example, in the German debate, I remember that around 2014, 2015, there were so many voices saying that, oh, you know, now Central and Eastern Europe is this Trojan horse of EU unity because they have this cooperation with China. Although, if you look at the data, German-Chinese cooperation was like this, and CEE China, like, it was just incomparable when it comes to scale. Like, Germany being, like, the powerhouse of cooperation between the EU and China, this is quite clear. But the political perception was that, oh, suddenly there is this mysterious format developing in Central and Eastern Europe that can be used to somehow disunite Europe.
I'm German, and we are the biggest economy in Europe. And Is there like expectations in Eastern Europe that, well, the German government would stand up and say, okay, we have to remeasure our engagement with China and we have to like...
It's very clear looking from the outside that there has been a change also in the way Germany looks at China. So, for example, the first China strategy of the previous German coalition government is a very good case in point. So, although it was very broad, not very specific, but that's what strategies are. They are just supposed to kind of describe the broader picture. It is clear that compared to the Merkel era, that document was really listing very serious grievances of the German government towards China on the economic front, on the security front, on the kind of multilateral behavior of China in third countries. You can have a great strategy, but you have to be able to implement it. And that's where the problem starts, because I guess that still in Germany, there are so many interest groups that are having diverging interests that it's very hard to bring all those people together to have a consensus that Germany has to be kind of the leading voice by the sheer fact that it's one of the most important EU countries. And if Germany can lead, many other countries would follow, because that's kind of the political message that many people in other parts of Europe expect. Because if, you know, you can be a small country like Lithuania and be extremely assertive, but if you cannot be supported or kind of shielded from China's economic coercion by bigger European countries, then your experience showcases that it's not worth it, that it's not worth to be actually assertive if it does not mean kind of support from other EU institutions and countries. And that's a big problem, that if there is this mistrust among Europeans themselves that there will be unity at the EU level vis-a-vis China, then even those actors who think that or feel that there's a need to be much more assertive or to have at least like a clear-eyed vision of how they want to still cooperate with China, what is the bottom line of cooperation, what kind of conditions should be established to make this cooperation feasible and in what areas? You know, there are so many questions, and I guess that there are ideas out there in Europe, for example, about conditionality of Chinese FDI. So how the EU can get together in order to create a shared understanding that, yes, we might still want and we probably need to cooperate with China in some areas, but we have to have new standards. We have to have new rules that are adequate to the political reality we're living in. So maybe it's now time to kind of reverse China's experience. If China in the 1990s was the country that was saying, yes, we welcome European investment, but only with joint ventures so that it can benefit Chinese companies as well. So maybe now is the time to say, well, we welcome Chinese investment. Like, we've seen your experiences over the past 30 years and they've led to like tremendous economic development. But, you know, now it's time for us to also fight for our kind of competitiveness. And yes, let's cooperate, but on certain rules. We want joint ventures with Chinese companies. We don't want this to benefit China only. We want to be kind of taken seriously and to have rules and standards that shield our economy from side effects of China's industrial policies. I think it's very important to kind of build a message that is aimed towards China by Europeans, in which we are very, very clear that what we are doing on the China front is not a result of US pressure. China has this tendency to think that, you know, everything that is happening in Europe that is more assertive, it's kind of a result of Washington putting pressure on Europeans, which is not the case. And we have our own interests. If there are problems with Chinese behavior, they have to be singled out. And Europe should be very consistent in kind of saying that if there's a problem, there's a problem. But at the same time, it's very important that China understands the fact that EU-China relationship is now undergoing this kind of a negative spiral is not the result of US policies. Look, like with Trump, we have a tremendous crisis on the transatlantic front. But still, Europeans are very much focused. The European Commission is very focused on talking about China through very similar terms as in the past 3, 4, 5 years. So this is irrespective of our US policy. If you talk to Chinese intellectuals, oftentimes there's this idea that, oh, you have some like pro-American politicians in the EU, like von der Leyen, for example. And if not for them, our relationship would be nice and stable. But, you know, von der Leyen, she's just voicing concerns of other European leaders, and she has her own logic as well. But like, I would not call her a pro-American politician, I guess. But that's how she's seen in China. And we'll see at the summit in Beijing later this month what kind of outcomes will be reached. It would be great to use like a new narrative to reiterate our interest and our willingness to still maintain a dialogue with China, but to be also treated as an equal. And the problem is that in many European countries, the feeling is very clear that we are not treated as equals and that the interest to engage with Europeans is not very high on China's end. All political and economic energy in Beijing is put into managing the rivalry with the US. The EU, by default, is also somehow sidelined. And of course, China has a much bigger capacity to create these policies and to think about these things by the sheer size of its population, how big the apparatus is. But it also means that this capacity will be and is being kind of used by the system to focus on the US-China rivalry. If you look at Europeans, our capacity to deal with China is also very limited. Like, it requires a lot of energy, a lot of effort, a lot of manpower to actually be able to maintain these discussions. And if they're not bringing results, what else can we do if we are not seeing on the side of Beijing any signs of willingness to be serious about this kind of cooperation? I was at this conference in Beijing on the 50th anniversary of EU-China relations organized by the EU delegation in May, and European speakers saying there is a problem of overcapacity, lack of level playing field, lack of market access. It's becoming more and more difficult for European companies to operate in the Chinese market. There are these surveys conducted by the European Chamber of Commerce in Beijing. There's a lot of evidence that European companies are not having the greatest of times nowadays in China. But then Chinese counterparts would just say, no, this is fake news. This situation is like you're exaggerating. That was the message, basically. It's very hard to engage with your counterparts if your concerns are just brushed off. Chinese diplomats are using certain terms like, multilateralism, for example, or win-win cooperation, that they have a certain meaning. But if you look at our European experiences, in many cases, these Chinese notions or the way Chinese officials understand some of these notions, they don't match our lived experiences in Europe or of European companies in China. And this mismatch is growing. So if China cannot really acknowledge European concerns, this would be kind of like the first step into having a real dialogue and a real conversation. If they don't acknowledge these concerns, I see a very, very limited space for any kind of serious development of this relationship.
But does the Chinese government take this European view seriously? Do they have to care?
I don't think they have. That's a problem, that they just think that Europe is a secondary player, that they have to focus on the US. And the historical experience also from China's perspective is that for a long time, there was this kind of wait and see approach on the side of the Chinese leadership. So China did not have to offer a lot of concessions to Europeans because bilaterally, it was quite easy to kind of use this divide and rule strategy, offering concessions to individual companies from individual member states like Germany, like France, like Italy, in some cases, Spain also. So kind of the biggest European players were the driving motor of EU-China relations because of China offering this kind of bilateral concessions to influence the broader EU-wide dynamics. And it has worked for a long time, but I think that now we're reaching the point where it's not going to work that easily for China anymore. But I think that the Chinese leadership might not have yet realized that.
Does the European Union have understood that? It sounds like we have to rethink our political measures against China or with China.
Yeah, definitely. I think at the level of the European Commission, there's a clear understanding of the scale of this challenge, but it's different in various European capitals. So when it comes to specific European nation states, there is still a lot of work when it comes to increasing this China literacy. And we need to look at China through much broader strategic lens, not only through the lens of bilateral immediate economic gains, because this is very short-sighted under current geopolitical conditions.
All right. Is this a topic you want to speak about or something we didn't mention? What is really important?
My last words would be, we have to take China seriously.
All right.
We should kind of try to get rid of this outdated perceptions of China, but we should also not orientalize China. So, okay, China is far away. It's a big country, but it's also it's not a country that is very mysterious. Like, the Chinese leadership is very clear when it comes to its strategic goals. There is plenty of evidence in the documents produced by the Chinese party state. So if you read through those, and this should be like a homework to European leaders to actually take seriously the messaging that is coming from China. And if we do that, I think that we have enough intellectual capacity in the EU to be able to somehow acknowledge China's behavior and China's interests and act accordingly. But we need political ambition and political will to do that. And this is still lacking, unfortunately. But there is hope, because the scale of this challenge is only going to grow. That's it. I don't know whether it's positive or negative, but that's the reality at the moment.
I think it's time to finish. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invite.
就是中国.
That's Why China, the China podcast from Thuringia in Germany, sponsored by the German Federal Ministry of Research, Technology and Space.